Hello, everyone, and welcome to the San Juan Snowcast. I'm your host, Chris. Today is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024, and you're listening to the final episode of the season, episode number 15. That's right, folks. We have finally made it to the end of the 2023-2024 winter season.
Closing time. Open all the doors and let you out.
Yep, it's time to enjoy those spring turns while we can and look fondly back on the winter that was. You know, this year was an interesting one. Kind of had a tough start, but also a strong finish, which made it feel like a bit of a roller coaster at times, with some pretty definitive lows in the early season, and then some all-time highs come March. So on this week's episode, I'm going to recap the season by looking at our seasonal snowfall history, how the snowpack changed throughout the winter, and then also by taking a look at some of this year's avalanche statistics. But the meat of this episode, well, it involves an avalanche survival story, one that happened just 1 year ago this weekend, outside of Silverton on King Solomon Mountain. Now, I don't want to say anything more about it, because it's a really good story, and I want you to hear it straight from the folks involved, but I will say that I left this one long because I think there's a lot of value in the details of this story. I don't do too many episodes over an hour long, but this one definitely feels worth it. Plus, also, final episode of the season, so you got the whole summer to listen to it. I went out for a tour last week in shorts and a Hawaiian shirt, and I skied a line that I'd been eyeing all season long. And you know what? It felt awesome. Go do it. Ski season, it's just a state of mind. And a wise mentor once told me, ski in the backcountry according to the snow on the ground, not the date on the calendar. And guess what? There is still plenty of snow on the ground. So slather on that sunscreen and put the spiky things in your pack, because spring is here and the snowcast starts now. All right. Well, before I start the show, I just want to say a huge thank you to all the companies and organizations that sponsored this season of the podcast. With their support, I hope to continue to keep Snowcast content completely free and never hidden behind a paywall. These sponsors and I believe that more information helps us all stay safer out there. And I am so incredibly grateful for their support. So a huge thank you to the Peter Ingalls Avalanche Education Fund, the Telluride Mountain Club, the Silverton Avalanche School, Mountain Trip, and Jagged Edge Mountain Gear. Thank you all so much. Let's kick things off with the state of the snowpack. The San Juan snowpack is currently sitting at 81% of its 30-year normal. This year's snowpack hit its peak on April 2nd, which is basically right on the 30-year average. And since then, it has been steadily declining, except for a brief blip on April 5th, when our last major storm deposited about a half inch of swee on top of the snowpack. When looking back at this winter, it was basically an overall average winter for our San Juan snowpack. It began below average, peaked above average, and is now melting out faster than average. But let's take a moment to reflect. Here's the 2023-2024 seasonal snowfall history for the San Juan Mountains, as I remember it. It all started with a storm just a day before Halloween, which deposited 0.4 inches of swee across the mountains and got our snowpack off to the races. Now, of course, in classic fashion, that snowfall sat there in the shady north-facing pockets and faceted out until November 19th, when the next storm finally rolled in. Numerous small storms throughout November and early December incrementally grew the snowpack and kept it tracking around 80% of average. Then we had a 10-day drought of high pressure from December 24th to January 4th, which created one of our many dreaded persistent weak layers. In early January, the snowfall returned, and from January 7th through February 1st, we had periodic storms and lots of avalanches. The first 9 days of February brought two major storms, with the second storm from February 6th through the 12th being the biggest snowfall event of our entire season. Now, during the storm cycle, we also had a major avalanche cycle with numerous D3-sized avalanches occurring naturally across the San Juans. But then, the tap turned off. And for the second half of February, we had high pressure and the mid-winter thaw. 2 weeks of mild weather and small little dust-up snow events helped our snowpack settle and gain some strength. Then on February 25th, the storms returned, and we saw 6 different snowfall events during the months of March and finally into April. Consistent snowfall from March 12th to the 18th brought our snowpack once again north of average, and it stayed above average until it peaked and began its decline around April 10th. Now since then, the snowpack has begun to decline rapidly. Save for a few meager snowfall events around April 5th and the 16th, April has been overall pretty sunny and warm, and the snowpack has been going fast, especially near and below treeline. But you remember what I've been saying all season? Never trust a facet until it's flowing down the river. Well, the avalanche danger currently is higher at lower elevations, especially on northerly aspects, where meltwater from the surface is percolating down into weak layers of faceted grains that have persisted in the shallower parts of our snowpack all season. Now, once that meltwater hits that persistent weak layer and we don't get a good refreeze overnight, we've got potential for wet slabs. And we are just now beginning to see natural and skier-triggered wet slab activity increase across the San Juans. Now, hopefully, colder overnight temps return and can lock things back up in the snowpack. And in fact, winter stormy weather appears to return to our area on Thursday night of this week, which will bring with it colder temps and hopefully a solid refreeze by this weekend. And how about some avalanche statistics from this season? Well, in the San Juans, there were 1,306 avalanches reported to the CIC this past winter. And of those avalanches, 156 were triggered by humans. Now, just for comparison, last season, there were 1,613 total avalanches observed, with 139 being human triggered. Now, this year, we also didn't see many really big avalanches. We only had 8 avalanches getting ranked as D3. But last year, we had 28 D3 avalanches and 3 D4-sized avalanches. And last year, we also had way more snow, but it's just interesting to note that difference. Now, one thing that is very noteworthy about the 2023-2024 winter season in the San Juans and across Colorado is that we've only had 2 avalanche fatalities across the entire state thus far this year. Now, both those accidents are incredibly tragic. We had the snowboarder here in Ophir and the skier in Crested Butte. And as a community, we mourn those 2 men who died doing the sport that we all love. But in comparison, it's pretty astonishing because last year, 11 people died across Colorado in avalanches. In fact, looking back at the last 15 winters in Colorado, this is the 2nd fewest avalanche fatalities we've had since the winter of 15-16, when only 1 person died in an avalanche across the state. It's definitely a noteworthy stat from this winter, especially since almost everyone seems to agree that the number of backcountry users in the state continues to increase year over year. So the question is, you know, are we getting better or are we getting lucky? Or is something else at play here? Looking at the nationwide numbers, 13 people were killed in avalanches across the U.S. this year, also down from last year's total of 30, and the lowest number of avalanche fatalities in the U.S. since the winter of 16-17. Now, I'm not going to throw out any theories as to why this is, but it is interesting, and I would love to see someone do an analysis of how avalanche deaths correlate to above or below average snowpacks, or El Nino versus La Nina years, but I'm certainly not the person to crunch those numbers. If you do crunch those numbers, please show me your results. You know, folks, all in all, I think we have a lot to be grateful for this winter. Our snowpack made an impressive rebound from a lackluster start to finish basically above average. We made it through the danger days of midwinter persistent slab tiptoeing with minimal involvements here in the San Juans, and we had a banger March with a pretty darn stable snowpack and lots of fun powder days. I mean, come on, raise your hand if you skied something fun above treeline this spring. Okay, good. Now keep your hand raised if it was steeper than 35 degrees. Nice. Now how about if it was a brand new line to you? Yeah? Rad. Nice work. Yeah, you know, we finally had the window to tick off some of those incredible alpine objectives that we have here in the San Juans. And I just want to say, I'm so stoked for all the folks who got to ski one of their dream lines, or a new line, or even just an old standard in good condition. Like I've said before, when it's good down here, it's really good. And this spring, it seemed like our community of backcountry crushers across the Wands picked off some of the coolest lines you can find anywhere in the mountains. It feels so good when, after waiting patiently all winter, we finally just get to tee off on all those queen lines. You know, there's nothing quite like it. So kudos to you all. Kudos to the folks who pushed their limits and got to try something new, but also kudos to the folks who just had a safe and steady season in the backcountry. Kudos to the folks who bailed or who made conservative terrain choices or who just stayed home or skied the resort when the danger was high. I'm super proud of all the folks who did the things necessary out there to make sure they get to have another season in the backcountry next year. And for those of you who are still out there grinding out corn lap after corn lap, well, good on ya. Despite spending last weekend in Moab, I'm totally still planning some big ski missions before the season turns to summer. After all, there is this sweet spot time of the year when the local county road and bridge crews plow out some of the alpine jeep roads, and you can just put on your skis right at the car at the snow line. There's nothing better than getting to drive to treeline and also ski corn right back down to your car. Get it while you can, folks.
Funk break!
Well, it's time to turn to the main focus of this episode, my conversation with Ryan and Isaiah about an avalanche incident that they were involved in this time last year. I hope you enjoy the story, and please stick around for my final thoughts at the end. Before we dive into this story, I want to just hear a quick introduction from both of you guys. I'm super lucky to have Ryan and Isaiah here with me today. It's late April 2024, and we're coming up on the one-year anniversary of an avalanche that happened last spring. But before I say more, would you guys mind just giving a little brief intro bio for listeners?
Sure. My name is Isaiah Branch Boyle. I'm a filmmaker and photographer. I grew up down in Durango, and my mom is Ute and Pueblo and Basque, and my dad's Irish, and I've been living up in Silverton for the past 4 years and making outdoor films, especially with a focus on Indigenous storytelling.
Yeah, thanks, Isaiah. If anyone's seen Spirit of the Peaks, then you know Isaiah's work. It's awesome. Thanks. Ryan?
My name is Ryan McClure. I've lived in the San Juan Mountains since around 2011 when I moved to Durango to go to Fort Lewis College, and have been a backcountry skier in this area pretty much ever since. And lucky enough to have moved up to Silverton a few years ago, and that's how I met Isaiah and how we started to ski together.
And you guys have been, you know, skiing together. We segued into this conversation by talking about that winter. And if we can all take ourselves back to last winter, it was a pretty epic year with a bunch of big storms and a really kind of strong and robust and deep snowpack, especially trending into the spring. So just give me a little bit of setup. Tell me about kind of where you were last April. The days leading up to this day of skiing you went out on King Solomon.
Yeah, absolutely. As you said, last winter was pretty great in a lot of ways. And both Isaiah and I had been skiing a lot since pretty much November. And, you know, we had been getting out into the backcountry at least a few days a week, if not more, consistently from November through, you know, April. And leading up to that April storm, things had kind of stabilized out in the high country. There hadn't been a lot of signs of activity outside of like small surface instabilities and things like that. And, you know, we had personally skied together, I think, twice the week before. Is that right? Twice,
yeah.
I think. And skied, you know, alpine north-facing stuff right after little storms. Had a lot of success, skied a lot of pow, had some really good times. And that leading up to skiing King Solomon, Isaiah and Connor came into the shop I work at in Silverton, and we chatted about potentially all skiing together. And settled on something that we had both kind of been looking at, which was this like northeast face of King Solomon, like the one of the sub peaks of King Solomon Mountain, which is kind of above Cunningham Gulch. And yeah, so we settled on skiing that the night before, made plans to meet the next morning, not remotely bright and early, at like 8 a.m. or something like that. And yeah.
I think last season, what a gift. Like, what an amazing, amazing winter. Like, so many good days, both personal skiing and filming skiing. Just like endless memories that, I mean, all of us will probably hold for the rest of our lives. And coming into that April, I mean, everything was fat. Everything looked amazing. Everything looked good. And it was kind of that time of the year that we start really filming the big alpine lines in Colorado. And Connor came down from Winter Park to film in the San Juans for a couple weeks. And, you know, it's different filming for fun than filming, or skiing for fun than skiing for filming. But we had spent a bunch of time skiing a lot of north-facing couloirs, and everything we got as far as feedback goes was super positive. The skiing was great, no signs of instability. And we were kind of looking at the shots that we were getting, and we're like, okay, we have a lot of couloirs and hallways and good views. Like, let's maybe go for a bigger alpine face. And so the idea of skiing King Solomon came up. And yeah, we talked to Ryan at the shop and see if he wanted to join, both just for fun and as like a way to have more people there than just Connor and I. And yeah, I mean, it's a north facing line, so we figured we didn't have to get going all that early to go get it done.
Totally. Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, hearing you talk about like the big face. We so rarely get to ski the big faces around here. And last year was one of those where it's like, wow, all the rock bands are filled in. You know, some of these steep lines are kind of anomalously in. And yeah, that's also where it's the reason we avoid those faces so much of the winter is because it's not like confined terrain and it's big, open, kind of spooky terrain. And we have wind slabs to contend with. And we get these like areas that are scoured back to rocks and then reloaded half through the winter. So yeah, I totally get that desire to want to ski a big face. And last year was kind of the year to do it. So, and then there was one more person in the group. Is that right? Was Tessa with you guys as well?
Yeah, it was a friend of mine who just happened to be visiting to ski for a couple of days. And we had some other objectives in mind for the next couple of days. And one thing I will admit from the very get-go is that we underestimated a little bit just how big this line was. I think the nature of how things had gone the last few days and the last few weeks of skiing, you know, it just, things were falling into place so easily that it seemed like something, especially they had plowed some roads that made access a lot easier. So it wasn't going to be, you know, an extra hour plus a skidding on both sides. And I personally had to work that day. Like I was, I had pushed out my work day. And so, and Connor, I think, might've been trying to leave for home. And so we definitely kind of underestimated a few little aspects like that. And just, we had a little bit of a time crunch, even though, you know, we started late, we just thought it was all going to kind of like fall into place like it had been.
Totally. And I think in the spring, like you can move pretty quickly. And especially when you're able to, I was actually mentioning that in the part of the pod I already recorded, how like we get this sweet spot window where you can drive up these plowed county roads and then get right to tree line or like above tree line and right to snow line and just go from there. And it kind of makes these objectives really easy to tag. So like walk me through the conditions, like the weather conditions, maybe like the 24 hours leading up to this day. And was there any like noteworthy things, or did you guys have any cause for concern on this day, or was it pretty much like green light?
Yeah. I mean, we had been out on the snow every single day for the week prior, but we also knew that there was a storm coming in. I went out the evening before and scouted it with a drone and got a bunch of footage, and we all went over it. So we knew what the surface was that the incoming storm was going to load on to. But for the most part, it seemed like, yeah, a spring snowpack with a storm, like hopefully some good storm, like spring pow on top of whatever was already there.
Nice. Yeah. Did it snow or like blow the night before?
Yeah, I think the prediction, if I'm remembering correctly, was like 2 to 4 inches in the Alpine. And we woke up to 4 to 5 on my deck in Silverton. And, or maybe it was more like 4. And, you know, so that was like kind of a pleasant surprise in a sense. I think we were expecting there to be more wind than snow. And initially the wind looked like it was going to come from the due north, which was absolutely a factor in us choosing this line. And was something we had discussed in the morning, was the fact that we were actually more concerned about what we were trying to ski was going to be really firm because all of it had blown away rather than being really, you know, being soft or having slabs on it, because it seemed like the wind was blowing in the direction that would have basically stripped the face rather than load it. And, you know, pretty typical spring storm for the San Juans, where it kind of blows in the evening, snows overnight, and then in the next morning it's kind of like clearing all morning. And but really pretty stable, low wind, you know, pretty stable and like not a lot of sun or anything like that early. And I definitely remember on the hike up when we switched over to crampons, looking up and seeing some, you know, some flagging coming off the peak. But I'm not sure if I remember that we discussed it or not at that point. So, you know, it was definitely, conditions were not as expected pretty much at any point from the time we woke up to the time we were dropping in.
But I could see, I'm putting myself in your shoes, like this sounds like a dreamy setup, right? You wake up and it's just like, oh, 4 inches and everything looks caked. I know that this day doesn't end in like high fives and beers at the car. So walk me through kind of what happens next, like how you end up ascending your line and what you see when you get to the top, and yeah, take us there.
Yeah, sure. We, you know, took it pretty casually that morning. There was some, during the skin, there were some like text messages that came through that were a little bit distracting, and like, we were talking more about that stuff rather than the conditions. And by the time we like got through kind of into the Alpine and switched to crampons, because there was a lot of soft snow on this, you know, this kind of rocky face that had been pretty much bare the day before, you know, we were like just kind of cruising along, not really just like thinking about, Isaiah was getting, you know, drone footage and, you know, we were talking about that kind of stuff, but we pretty quickly ascended the line. I don't think it took us less than 2 hours, if I'm remembering right, from the time we left the car to the time, or maybe a little over 2 hours. Either way, we were on the summit a little before noon, maybe around 11:30 or so, and just, it, you know, it, we were surprised to see how soft the face looked. It, like, you know, I'm tossing rocks into it, kind of smacking it with my pole, like testing it a little bit. And it just looks like that, as you said it earlier, that kind of dream setup, like a firm, but like stable, like caked face with about 4 to 4+ inches of snow on it. And we were getting, at least I was getting pretty psyched. And yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there was a time crunch involved, but it's a long climb up there, but then it's like 3,000 to 4,000 feet almost directly back to the road, back to a car that we had set up. So we were on top and knew that like, as soon as we dropped in, it was going to be over quickly.
Totally. So you get up to the top, and is there much wind that day, or is it pretty much like a blue sky kind of classic spring day in the San Juans?
It was blue sky, but definitely windy. We were on the ridge, and with the fresh snow, we were kind of getting sandblasted there on the top. Yeah, and kind of spreading out, picking our lines, picking, you know, where Connor was going to drop in to film and where Ryan and Tessa were going to drop in and where I was going to film from. So yeah, wind definitely played a factor that day in a big way. And
One thing I remember very clearly from standing up there was, you know, most of the ascent was like, felt pretty warm. Like I was in my spring skiing, like base layers, and, you know, brought my spring skiing layers and don't have, you know, wasn't wearing like my warm midwinter kind of touring get up. And I remember standing on the summit and putting on my mittens and being like, man, this feels like winter up here right now. Like it does not feel like, you know, hot. The sun doesn't feel hot. There's, you know, a lot of fresh snow, a lot more maybe than we were expecting. And I was like, remember that it felt like winter. And just talking about that with Tessa, and, you know, that's probably, you know, if we want to like jump ahead to looking back at some stuff, that's one of those factors that I think is, you know, potentially we overlooked and should have been played a greater, you know, greater part in our decision making. Because when you're feeling, when it feels like winter, all of a sudden winter like problems, you know, creep back into the game plan. You got to start thinking about those as well.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. And it's not always like a big obvious red flag, you know. It's sometimes these little feelings or like the observations of like, oh, the wind on my cheek. It's like, huh, that's noteworthy. And it's often so subconscious in the moment, you know, we're just experiencing it and you're like so stoked to ski the line. And obviously I think we get to the top of objectives and immediately start planning our descent. I do this all the time. I'm like, I'm going to hit down this way and then hit that and go that way. And I'm not even thinking of the like reason to stop and assess, you know. Sometimes you just see the snow and you're like, I want to go, especially this time of year. So then there was a couple different people all skiing this North Face. I know we're filming. What were the logistics like? Was that kind of easy to figure out? I guess Connor's going to drop first for sure. But talk to me about that. And then ultimately, yeah, that moment when you kind of drop into this big North Face.
Yeah, I think we had talked about it previously, like the night before, with it being such a big face and wanting to get footage of it. I was kind of taking techniques that I'd learned up in Alaska and applying it to that kind of face, where you ski the first 300 or 400 feet all out, like you would see in a ski movie. And then you shut it down and you kind of have fun and or survival ski the rest of the way down. And
yeah,
that like huge face on King Solomon is kind of that line. And yeah, so we had talked about that. I was set up a little bit lower on the ridge where I could launch and land a drone easier out of the wind. Connor was dropping in from the tippy top, and Ryan and Tessa were set up just a little bit farther away. And yeah, I mean, we got everything set up, got the drone in the air. It looked beautiful, and Connor dropped in.
What time was this?
It was right before noon, maybe right at noon on the dot. And, you know, at this point, the sun had kind of cleared the clouds had kind of cleared out. Things had definitely, you know, gone full blue. And all of a sudden, like those spring feelings were kind of coming back in. And one thing that, you know, because we were filming and Tessa and I dropped back below the ridge line rather than watch Connor ski for aesthetic purposes, which, you know, for sure. We did not watch him ski. All I saw of him skiing was like some slough coming out when I popped up to try and see where he was at after we heard that he had, you know, started to take a tumble and, you know, had gotten kind of caught up by this little avalanche that, you know, it was more of like a point release, but like right around his feet. And because of that, didn't watch him ski, and, you know, things got a little bit more complicated at this point, to say the least. All of a sudden Connor's stranded on the face and has lost both of his skis and is in a pretty precarious place. And so we quickly talked about our next move, and Isaiah and I were talking on the radio about where Connor was, where his skis were, and then whether or not he would go help him out or I would go help him out. Mm-hmm. And at this point, I already had my skis on. I was already kind of ready to drop into what I was planning on skiing, which, you know, put me at what I thought was a pretty good spot to basically try and cross this face and get to his ski and like try to initiate a ski cut. And I, based on the previous like 6 months of skiing, you know, there had been this like pretty consistent feedback loop of decision making where pretty much every time I wanted to trigger an avalanche, both inbounds, out of bounds, wherever, I had triggered an avalanche with like a little ski cut or like a little drop into like, you know, top of like some little tree lane, or, you know, just like making a turn on a little face and it, like a little wind slap pops out. And, you know, based on that, and then also this part of that feedback loop being every time we expected to see avalanches last season, we saw avalanches. Every time we didn't expect to see avalanches, we didn't see avalanches. There was pretty much never a day where I went skiing last year where I had some sort of red flag that wasn't expected. And that consistent amount of feedback over the course of the whole season kind of got to my head a little bit. And I wouldn't say that I could do no wrong, but I certainly thought that when I dropped into the top of this face, that it was just going to kind of point release at my feet and kind of flush out the potential danger so I could cross the slope safely and get to Connor.
Connor's in a safe spot down below.
Right? Yeah. That's another thing, is we had communicated with Connor and he was, you know, uncomfortable, you know, just taken a pretty gnarly tumble and was now like kind of perched underneath this rock band. And, you know, as safe as he could possibly be at that time. And so instead of kind of listening to, you know, both Tessa was like, do you really want to drop right here? Do you want to go around? I was like, nope, I think this is going to be, it's going to release right under my feet and I'm going to be fine. And I'm going to cross this thing, get his skis, and we're going to get the hell out of here. And you know, spoiler alert, it didn't go that way.
Yeah. So you kind of make the call, you're going to cut across, and then how quickly, once you're on the slope, do you realize, or did it avalanche?
You know, less than 5 seconds, probably, maybe about 6 or 7 seconds. You know, it's like very vivid in my mind still, that whole process. Cause I remember kind of drop cutting into the top, right? Just like tried to get it to go at my feet. And it was a lot deeper than I thought. It was like way more than 6 inches, like almost boot top. And I was like, whoa, that's crazy. And one thing that became apparent when I realized that was that I had to like continue across the slope. There was no like backing out at that point. It was too steep and like too exposed to kind of like sidestep back up because I was already moving across. And so I tried to keep my momentum and like initiate a ski cut below my feet, but it just took me too far down the slope. And all of a sudden there was this little kind of convexity that broke up Connor and I's lines, like the perfect spot to like trigger this slab. And it like just kind of unloaded. Like I watched it spider up like above me, like 20, 30 feet. Just the whole hanging face. And I just was like, and
yeah,
tried my best to kind of dig my skis in, try and like dig my pole in, but it pretty quickly overwhelmed me. And I kept doing my best to just dig my skis in, but it just pulled me off this little cliff band, tumbled me a little bit. And then it was like white room, tumbling down this thing, just trying to kick my feet in as best I could, trying to get my skis in, because, you know, of course I had locked them out so they weren't coming off well, not easily, and doing everything I could to slow myself. I definitely, it wasn't one of those moments where I was like, oh gosh, am I dying? I'm seeing my whole life flash before. It wasn't anything like that. It was all just like fight, 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 fight. And, yeah. You know, I don't remember how long.
This face is like 40, 45 degrees. Like you're tomahawking, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I mean that upper 200-300 feet, I think is like high mid 45 to like 50. I think at the very tippy top where I was crossing, of course. And, you know, it doesn't really relent for around 1,000+ feet. I remember going airborne a couple times, and the second time I went airborne, it was like long enough for me to think, this is going to really hurt. Like when I land, it's going to really, really hurt. And I remember landing on my butt and like having this like momentary thought of like, holy shit, I might save this thing. And that's the moment I got pitched like forward and impacted right above my knee into my femur and like explode. And, you know, at that point, it's just like tumble, total, like, you know, skis fly off, like skis literally break off my feet. And I'm like tumbling along, rolling kind of like a log sideways, and I could feel my leg underneath me like twisting opposite of my body and my like, I, you know, luckily didn't hit my head, luckily didn't hit anything else, like didn't hit my chest or my back or like all these other places that if I had hit might have, you know, I might have died before I even had a chance to think about anything. But I remember thinking like, oh gosh, this is really bad. And that was probably around the time that it started to slow down and I felt myself kind of getting buried. Like the debris was kind of getting on top of me. So I fought as hard as I could to kind of get on top, dug myself up, and it unbelievable, like pulling snow out of my mouth, like just trying like, and I could hear like the radio chatter behind me, where my radio had gotten torn off my pack, but was still attached. And like, and I like came to a stop and kind of like unburied myself a little bit, 'cause my like one arm was free, but you know, there wasn't a lot of snow on top of me, and started unburying myself. And I, you know, reached back and grabbed my, radio and radioed up to everybody up top and told them that I was alive and unburied, but it at least, you know, felt like my leg had kind of been torn off. And, you know, yeah, I guess that's I'll leave that bit at that.
Whew. Yeah. And did you immediately know how bad it was? Sounds like you did. Or were you in immediate pain?
You know, I wasn't necessarily in immediate pain, but I definitely knew how bad it was. It didn't take me very long to unbury my like lower body a little bit with my hands. And I could see my femur like poking through my ski pants. And like it was hard to tell. I knew it was my femur because I could feel it, but you know, I don't think many people initially thought it was my femur when they showed up and saw it. So I was pretty mangled and, you know, tried to reposition myself as best I could while we were communicating on the radio. And, you know, I told them to press their inReach and call my girlfriend, because one thing that was pretty amazingly fortunate about this whole accident was we had service on the summit. Wow. And I guess, you know, I'll leave some of that next bit out and kind of pass it off to Isaiah here, because I think what he, you know, did next was as important as anything I did.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the problem of Connor still being on the slope without his skis hasn't been solved. And yeah, it sounds like it just got way more hectic and stressful. So Isaiah, talk us through what happened next.
Yeah, totally. I mean, because of like what the face was like and where everyone was positioned, like I was kind of the only one with eyes on through the drone. And so Connor dropped in first, you know, took a bad fall, lost his skis. And, you know, like sometimes that happens. And so we were just like, oh, like we just need to get him his skis back and then we'll all make our way down the face safely. And so we discussed it, you know, we already have one person stranded on the face, but he just needs his skis. And so I located a rock band and asked Connor to move over to it and he booted over to it. So at least he was like in a safe space in case any other snow came down. And then when Ryan came into the line and triggered the avalanche, all of a sudden, you know, we've got two people down. And, you know, yeah. I checked in with Connor. He was okay. Like he was in a good, safe place as the avalanche went past him. And I was able to locate and get eyes on Ryan as he was like digging himself out of the debris at the bottom. And then it became this thing where all of a sudden, you know, we have two people on this line and we don't know like how many more avalanches we can really trigger and how many more people we can send down the line safely, since we've already sent two people down the line and it hasn't gone very well for them. And yeah. It's apparent, like, I mean, Ryan communicated that like his leg was off and I'm like, you know, there's a lot of big arteries around there. Like, you know, we were really dealing with like a ticking time bomb as far as like Ryan, like basically bleeding to death was like what was going through my mind. And so I had eyes on Ryan, I had eyes on Connor, and I communicated to Connor that like if there was anybody that was going to be able to make it down to Ryan in time to save his life, it would be Connor. He was already on the face and we didn't want to send anybody else down. And I was able to get eyes on a couple of skis that Connor could use for a rescue sled. And there was definitely some back and forth of Connor trying to come to terms with like, he was the one, even though he was injured and just taking a fall, like he was the one to go down and rescue Ryan. And so once he started making his way down, I started making phone calls, which is crazy. It's like, these guys are like fighting for their lives and I'm like making extreme phone calls.
You know? Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
Life saving calls. With service.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I like didn't exactly know what to do, but I knew that like our good friend Jack Klim, who is a big part of San Juan Expeditions, would know the exact protocol to go through. And so I called him first and he was at the guide shop and he set the protocol in order and like ran across the street with the phone in hand to search and rescue to start getting that initiated. And we able to talk to search and rescue immediately, tell them where we were exactly, what was happening and what our plan was. And they were able to kind of start kickstarting things and getting a plan in motion. And once that plan was in motion, I called Ryan's girlfriend, Lindsay, and told her, you know, there's been an accident. Everyone's alive and that we're going to do our best to like get everybody down safely. And then at that point, the in-reach message made it to search and rescue and told search and rescue that there was an injured hiker on King Solomon.
Yeah. The perks of a small mountain town community, like the word of mouth train was much faster than the satellite communications, turns out.
Totally.
So the wheels are in motion, thanks to help from friends in Silverton. And yeah, and Connor's working his way down to Ryan. What happens next when Connor gets to you, Ryan?
Yeah, you know, the 20 minutes or so that I sat there was probably some of the toughest 20 minutes of my life. A lot of thoughts going through your head, a lot of weirdness, a lot of thinking about, you know, not making it out of there. And, but I could just see him slowly walking down to me, getting like, not slowly at all, actually. He was like basically sprinting down the face by the time he got to me. And, you know, it was pretty clear by the time he was able to reach me that like there was no way I was going to be moving myself anywhere. Like I had tried to kind of like crawl out of like the middle of the gut of this thing, and that wasn't going to happen. So I set myself up on a pack, on my pack, which I did not get out like any of my first aid kit, none of my rescue kit, none of my, like, didn't get my puffy out or like any of these things that in retrospect, I probably should have pulled out of my pack and would have been really helpful during those next, the next couple hours. But Connor got to me and basically the very first thing he did was apply like a ski scrap tourniquet to my leg. And, you know, that's, tourniquets are often discussed as like, do you want to bring something like this into the backcountry in your med kit? Are you going to really be able to utilize this properly? And this was definitely one of those moments that it would have been pretty helpful, especially if I had had actually had an arterial bleed, which I got very fortunate, and then I wasn't bleeding arterially. If I had been, it's hard to say if I would have made it long enough for him to get down there. I mean, I tried to apply a ski strap to my own leg, and I'll tell you that didn't work. So, you know, basically at that point, it was just about Connor trying to provide as much first aid as he possibly could while the rest of the party figured out how they were going to get down to us. And, you know, we were communicating with them the whole time, but, you know, it kind of became me and Connor in our own little world, just trying to like, trying to make a space for like his rescue tarp, which he, you know, happened to have a So Alpine shout out rescue tarp. Totally. And
wow,
like while like, you know, he's looking at his med kit and like digging through his like little tiny gauze patches and it's like, none of this is gonna do anything. Like I can't actually, this isn't, none of this covers like this wound, it's too big. And so we're just trying to figure out what's the best way to like take care of me, but also take care of him and then get everybody down to us. And Isaiah was working hard on that and figuring out how they could get down to us and provide some assistance.
Yeah, I was just using the drone to keep eyes on them and see how progress was going with Connor getting down as I was talking to search and rescue on the phone. And then, you know, scouted another line down the mountain that would keep us out of the main gut and kept us out of danger of kicking any more snow down on Connor and Ryan as they're down there. And once we had communicated as many details as we possibly could with search and rescue, Tessa and I decided that it was time to start making our way down the line. And we down climbed a lot of the first bit and then put our skis on, skied a little bit of this rocky ridge, a lot of like dry skiing and down climbing with your skis on. And then we were finally able to wrap around into the face and get down to Ryan and Connor. And at least, I mean, those initial turns off of the ridge down to them were great skiing, if we're being honest. The nice. Snow was really good.
Just one bright spot. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, another anecdote is that I could hear Connor singing a song in Lakota, and I knew it wasn't like a death song. And so I knew that like we still had a chance. And so we decided to keep, you know, rushing down there towards Ryan and Connor to try to do our best to get him down the mountain. And when we showed up, I think Connor had done all he could as far as ski strap tourniqueting Ryan's leg. I had another big ski strap, so I put another ski strap tourniquet on his leg to just try to stop more of the bleeding. And then we got to work transitioning Ryan onto the rescue sled.
And yeah, I'm just curious, you know, we talk about the stuff we carry in our first aid kits and we like practice putting someone in a rescue sled in a avalanche rescue course, but how did that actually go? Was this like a above the knee, like 6 inches above the knee kind of tourniquet placement? And then was it effective? Like, was there a lot of bleeding still? You don't have to get too gory, but I'm just curious from the medical side.
I mean, it is actually really, I think it's really important to touch on that, because my surgeon called it the perfectly bad tourniquet. And, you know, when I was still in the hospital a few days later, it's not something that he would ever recommend. But it worked, and, you know, you got to make do with what you've got. It was exactly like probably about 6 inches above where my femur had gone through my knee. And, you know, the first one maybe didn't cut off the bleeding all that much, but the second one definitely like helped with that. It seemed like, at least for me, you know, that pain was the worst thing I've ever experienced for sure when that got applied. It's, you know, one of those things that I will definitely bring a tourniquet in my med kit moving forward. There's like very few scenarios where it's going to be useful, but the scenarios where it is useful, it is literally life saving. And knowing when and how to apply it is, I think, extremely important. And I think that's the biggest worry about, you know, telling everybody to put a tourniquet in their med kit is you really should take like a wilderness first responder course and like have knowledge of how to use those things, because that kind of also moves us into the, like, the rescue sled. Like, we've all, you know, anybody who's taken a rescue course or level two or level one has put somebody in a rescue sled at this point, at least around here in the San Juans. And it is not as easy when you are in the middle of, you know, a 3,700 foot line, like on the one little bench and the whole thing, and then move down through avalanche debris and like properly setting up that rescue tarp and then utilizing it in that scenario requires at least three people on like helping to, like, you know, because if the patient is truly incapacitated in that sense, like I was, like, You need a lot of manpower, a lot of strength, and like the right ropes, the right everything to make that work just barely in that kind of situation.
Yeah, I was just about to say, you guys were in pretty steep terrain. You know, I've watched the video of the SAR team finally lowering you down, and I'm like, it's steep. So did you have a rope with you or cordelette? How'd that go? Did the skis go in the sled, or what was that process like?
Skis went in the sled, and I'll admit that we did not properly like kind of protect the edges maybe. And that's something that I would have maybe changed. Not that I had a lot of choice in how it was all done. And we used some paracord rather than, like, we didn't carry a rope that day because we knew there were no rappels or anything like that. So, you know, we used some paracord that we had in our, you know, a couple of, like, you know, few hundred, like 100 foot length of paracord, and it got the job done in a sense. But it's, in practice, you got to have all the tools and have been practicing with a rescue sled to like make it work well.
Yeah. And you're, at the end of the day, like lowering somebody down through avalanche debris, which is just never going to be easy, even if you have perfect tools, even if you have three skiers and four search and rescue and a perfect sled, like, it's still just going to be extremely difficult.
But I mean, in a sense, would you say that you were glad you had it because it gave you the ability to move instead of kind of being stuck there? Or?
Oh yeah. I don't want anyone to take that wrong. We absolutely are. I'm incredibly grateful that we had a rescue sled. It was a huge game changer in terms of how search and rescue, got to us, because they made a decision to come up from the bottom rather than come up and over from the top because we were moving downhill, which likely saved, you know, who knows like how much time. But in a scenario like we're like bleeding out like that, I was, the less time that I could be, you know, in pain like that and like on that slope, the better. And it made things much more efficient in that regard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The rescue sled, I think, was like our most essential piece of first aid or rescue equipment. Like, you show up to someone and they have an exposed femur, you pull out your first aid kit and you're like, what am I going to do with these band-aids or this little thing of gauze that I brought? Like, You know, like in those huge scenarios, like a lot of that minor stuff isn't that helpful. But yeah, the sled was definitely really, really crucial for getting Ryan down the mountain.
So at the end of this, I think you guys brought so much stuff that was really essential for helping you have like the best possible outcome. I'd be curious to hear like the things you are really happy you had and then the things you still wish you had had that day. Mm-hmm. But before we get there, let's finish this story because it's a really good one. And so you're moving down the mountain at this point. What time did SAR show up on the scene? And yeah, talk us through like how come they didn't decide just to like come with a helicopter and long line you off the face or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have the timeline right in front of us. Read it off. The InReach was pressed and like we made contact with SAR at 12:31. The Flight for Life was dispatched at 12:55 on the dot. And two Silverton Medical Rescue members began touring up the slope at like 2:20. Which Flight for Life dropped them at the base of the line. SAR made contact with us at 3 p.m., and they began the ski lower at 3:40. So from time of accident, which was like maybe 12:10, 12:05, to like SAR making contact with me was, you know, less than 3 hours, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah. That's amazing. So they did use a helicopter to insert the SAR members.
Yeah, that is the, you know, making radio or making cell phone contact with search and rescue was so invaluable in that way because they were able to pass along just how critical my condition was, like very quickly. And so the decision to put Flight for Life in the air and like who would be there for them to pick up was, you know, very easy. And Search and Rescue did actually Flight for Life and one of the members of SAR here in Silverton presented on this at the Medical Mountain Symposium this last year. And So I got to attend that, which is pretty cool, and see like all these people who were part of my, you know, saving my life. And it was really interesting to hear them discuss like what they would have done differently, what they were really happy with the way they did things. Like a lot went right this day. And in terms, pretty much everything after I started sliding went about as well as it possibly could.
There's always that saying, if you're going to have something bad, have it happen on the blue sky day, middle of the day at noon with lots of daylight still left. Like all those circumstances are pretty awesome. So how did this ultimately resolve itself? I mean, they lower you down to the waiting helicopter and you fly away, Ryan. Is that how it went?
Yeah, more or less. They put me into a sked versus the rescue sled because our rescue sled was completely trashed by the time they got to us. I don't know if it would have made, without some like serious reconfiguration and like, I don't know if we would have made it down the whole line. And so when they reached us, we had already kind of, well, I shouldn't say we, I was laying there. But like Isaiah and Tessa and Connor were prepping like a space for them to like move me into their rescue sled, their sked, and like, you know, perform first care and like perform, you know, give me drugs, which I was very fortunate in that the first person up the line to me was a paramedic who has the ability to give me good drugs in the field, which honestly, you know, by that point I was fading big time. I don't remember very much, if anything, from them that point on, you know, outside of little nuggets of like floating through the air, thinking I was skiing and like, you know, kind of floating through the trees, looking down like, wow, ketamine's great. But, it's, you know, at that point it was just, they had to do some incredibly difficult ski lowers, really challenging through this like old wet slide debris. And yeah, and like with the warming of the day, like there was a lot of concern about overhead hazard and like something else coming down. And no matter what in this line, you are in the path when you are in it.
Yeah. Gotcha. What time, how long did it from them kind of getting on scene to them getting you in the helicopter? You said that they started the sled lower at 3:40.
Yeah, they started the sled lower at 340, and I was in Flight for Life, or I was at the base at 410. So it took about, 30 minutes or so, and then less than 20 minutes later, Flight for Life took off, and I was at Mercy Medical in Durango right around 5 p.m. in the ER. So less than 5 hours between, right around like a little over or a little under 5 hours between time of accident to definitive care at a hospital, which is frankly incredible and something that I am so unbelievably grateful for at this point. It's just like that condensed timeline is probably the reason I still have a leg. Like if things had been extended out another 2 hours, who knows what, you know, what that next surgery would have looked like. And so, yeah.
Yeah. 5 hours is incredible. And, you know, like you said, a lot of things went right. I've been on the other side of this, you know, Ryan, I've been on the ground watching a friend be helicoptered away. And so I'm just curious, like Isaiah, from your perspective, it's you, Tessa and Connor. And now it's like, well, the helicopter's left. What was that kind of feeling like? And yeah, what did you all do next?
I mean, we got back into the car and drove back to Silverton, debriefed with search and rescue, and kind of just waited by our phones to hear news about how Ryan was doing. Mm-hmm. I think our big checkpoints were first, like, when Tessa and I were able to get to Ryan and he hadn't bled to death. Like, and then getting him down the line was another big checkpoint. And once he had gotten to the hospital, we're like, I mean, unfortunately, we had done all we could have done at that point.
Totally.
And so we were like, I mean, this is going better than we thought it was going to go.
Was there a big like emotional release? I know, I feel like when those things happen, you just kind of go into operator mode. And like you said, you have checkpoints. You're like, okay, we can get here to this point and this point. Was there like a big emotional kind of dump after that?
Yeah, I definitely remember having a time where we were all just sitting outside of the fire station at Silverton and like we're able to sit on some dirt that had some grass growing and we just like weren't really saying much and just like kind of like grabbing the grass and the dirt and like marveling that we were all still alive. I think that was like a big emotional release for sure.
Yeah, totally. It's so powerful. And you know, it's like, in a way, it's like, oh, the incident ends when the person's in the hospital and you're like, you can breathe that sigh of relief. But sometimes like, yeah, the processing has only just begun. So before we dive into kind of some big takeaways and lessons learned, Ryan, just walk us through like the extent of the injuries and your rehab. And I'm sure that was a long, hard journey, but
I mean, absolutely. Yeah. So I had it. Compounded distal femur fracture is like the nitty gritty, I think it's like type 5 or whatever, where basically the bottom part of my femur exploded and on the impact. And then what was left of my shaft of my femur pushed through and tore my patellar tendon completely. I got incredibly fortunate in that none of my other like important knee ligaments suffered much damage, which is like hard to believe, but, yeah. And so basically they cleaned me up, like pulled little bits and pieces of Gore-Tex and like needles and stuff out of my knee, made sure everything was still there. Cause that was like a big concern, is like all the pieces of bone still here. Cause that's really important. And they kind of like externally fixated my leg and then put me in an ambulance, drove me to the Durango hospital and flew me to Denver to a trauma one center in Lakewood called St. Anthony's Hospital, which I'm sure some people on this are familiar with. And I had another surgery that early in the morning, the next day. And then I was in the hospital for 5 days. I had my definitive surgery, which is when they put it all back together and take that external fixator off, on day 3 or 4 in being in the hospital. And I was actually out of the hospital like 3 days later. So, it was pretty quick turnaround. And I mean, I had kind of a perfect scenario at home, to go home early. I had medic betrayed family and like a really easy place to like set up, no stairs, nothing. I didn't have to like pass any therapy tests before going home, which is, I think, a pretty typical thing. And I also didn't have any infections, and I didn't have like compartment syndrome and all these other things that tend to come up when you have these like really traumatic lower leg injuries. And I was out of the hospital in early May, and I was in the Front Range at my parents' place for 2 months, kind of like on bed rest, basically in a wheelchair, going to the Butterfly Pavilion and like hanging out. And I was back in Silverton around July, and a lot of PT, 3 days plus a week of PT, and lots of time without non-weight bearing, like 9 weeks of non-weight bearing, 9 months of not being able to walk without assistance of some sort, like a cane or things like that. I had another surgery in October of this last year, and so I'm about 6 months out from my last surgery, and I'm skiing. So I've had a pretty blessed recovery, and am pretty lucky to like not only be standing on two legs, but like be able to ski Silverton Mountain closing day, and like not just like barely get down the slope, but I'm actually like able to have a little bit of fun, like rip around with my friends again. And coming into a year here in 6 days from when we're recording this, it's like I'm feeling pretty lucky to be where I'm at, laying out there in the field. If you had told me that less than a year later I'd be, you know, skiing at all, or like alive, like having a leg, like I wouldn't have believed it, laying there, you know, looking at my bone pointing out of my leg. Like it's like it's gone as well as it possibly can, I think, in a lot of ways. And I'm, you know, not without a lot of work, but you know, I'm just mostly just grateful and really appreciative.
Yeah, that's so surreal to have that experience of seeing part of your body like so disconfigured, and then ultimately having it come back to the realm of functionality. It's awesome. And I'm really stoked for you, Ryan. Happy to hear all that. And yeah, shallow of a year and you're back to skiing. It's pretty sweet. You know, I think this story hits home for me because it's like super, I can just 100% relate to what you guys did that day. Looking back, you know, you said it was a wind slab, and I'm just curious, you know, whenever these accidents happen, hindsight's 2020, obviously. And I know, Ryan, you've done some presentations where you've like gone through all the bullet points of takeaways and big lessons learned, but is there one thing that really sticks with you from this day, whether it's like one piece of gear you had or one thing that you have like prepared in your backcountry experience, you know, whether it's like preparing for that worst case scenario? Yeah. Is there one thing that kind of is like a major takeaway? It's like, wow, that made the day what it was, or that made the day, it could have made the day a lot worse, potentially.
I think the biggest thing, or at least that I've come away with, is like the people you're up there with are your most important assets for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, like if Codner hadn't been there to help Ryan, it would have been totally different. You know, if I hadn't been up on the ridge with Tessa, my experience would have been horrible. Like, I think first and foremost, who you're going into the backcountry with is the most important thing to consider. And then from there, you go into terrain choice and kind of go down the line of other things. But as far as like gear and stuff goes, like, yeah, first and foremost, it's like, who are you going out with?
Absolutely. I think that's a really good point. It's not what's in our pack always.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. And that, like, it was the first time that Connor and I had ever skied together. And, but through, we had spent a lot of time chatting over the last, you know, a few months, and like had kind of like gauged each other a little bit before going out. And like, he knew that Isaiah and I, you know, had a good, had some good days out in the mountains together. And like, Tessa was like, you know, was a close friend who, you know, I would do, you know, anything with out in the backcountry. And it's, I got very fortunate that those three people happened to be the people who were there to take care of me and help me get out of there. And yeah, I'm very, very grateful in that regard. It's like, that's something I am going to always consider, you know, first and foremost moving forward as I like start to tiptoe back out, you know, beyond the realm of chairless in the next couple years, is I'm not going to take my partners lightly. And, you know, is this someone who, if we happen to have the worst day of our life, is this, you know, is this person like a good person to have with me on that day?
Yeah, absolutely. We always joke, but it's like our lives are in each other's hands out there. Is there anything you would have done differently looking back on that day?
Do we have another whole podcast? I mean, the obvious things are I would have just paid a little more attention to the feelings of the day and what was going on. And I think it's a good thing at the top of line when an accident occurs or something happens that's not necessarily the plan. It doesn't even need to be an accident. It doesn't even need to be somebody getting caught and losing their skis or whatever. But if something happens that was unexpected, to like make sure they're okay as best you can, but rethink your next choice a couple times. Like really, really think about it. Like, am I just reacting or am I acting rationally? Because my reaction to Connor getting caught and losing his skis was, I need to go help my friend and I need to get on this slope and as quickly as possible in order to help him. And with hindsight, it's really obvious that we should have probably come in from where he went in and, you know, changed our plan of attack significantly.
Yeah, I know the urgency you feel when you see something happen to someone else and then suddenly all of our self-preservation goes out the window and it's like, I just need to respond. I totally get that. All right. I guess just one last question. I'll bring it home with that gear question of just like one thing you were really grateful you had that day. And then is there anything you wish you'd had? It sounds like maybe the tourniquet.
Yeah, tourniquet is probably maybe number two on the list or number one of things that I mean, I also didn't pull my med kit out. So if I'd had a tourniquet, I don't know if there's anything we could have done with it. So yep. I think it's more like what gear I'm really grateful that we had. And that would be like, I'm glad everyone had radios. I'm glad we had multiple inreaches because I had an inreach, Connor had an inreach, but we were both in the face, you know, and had it just been the two of us or Isaiah had been on the summit and not been able to communicate with us, totally different, you know, how the day would have played out. Like, how do you move forward if you can't communicate?
Yeah. Communication seems super critical in that sort of situation when you lose eyes of your partner and you don't know what's going on down there. Also, it seems like the drone played a huge role in that as well of maintaining kind of visual comms. How do you think that was kind of a helpful tool in this whole endeavor?
Yeah, it was huge. And in an instant, it turned from being like a artistic tool to all of a sudden being like a safety tool and a way to keep eyes on everybody. And especially like the drone paired with the radios was extremely helpful to still have eyes on everybody and still be able to communicate with everybody. Like, yeah, it was really critical that day. Like, do I think everybody should like bring a drone into the backcountry for every line? Like, probably not. But like in the moment, like, you know, we were able to like adapt these tools of filmmaking in order to like save our friends' lives. And I am really, really, really grateful to have that drone.
Oh yeah. No, and I will say I've seen them used in search and rescue applications and I think they're a really cool tool for multiple applications. And yeah, it's just interesting how much technology kind of came to play in this day, but how it ultimately, yeah, makes a difference, the things we carry with us.
Yeah. And I mean, one other note is like, especially in the San Juans, like the difference between 30 and 35 degrees and like 45 and 50 degrees is an entire world of difference in how snow reacts and how it moves. And I think that that was another thing that, like, when we stepped out onto that north face, we were dealing with a degree of angle that, like, we hadn't been on most of the season. Because most of the time during the season in the San Juans, we don't get on 45 to 50 degree terrain. It just doesn't get snow on it. And so we don't have a lot of experience with how that moves and how it reacts. And so I think that that's totally, like, as far as like key takeaways for backcountry skiers, is like slope angle matters a lot, especially in Colorado.
Yeah. And so rarely are we able to be skiing those slopes that we don't talk about slough management here or things like that, or, you know, how to ski a line like hard and fast and in it, kind of in that AK style you were talking about earlier, Isaiah. It's such a rare opportunity that when it finally arises, it's easily to be caught off guard, for sure, in that type of terrain. Yeah, I think a big takeaway for me too is just how it can be spring and then we get these little winter storms and suddenly, bam, we're back into kind of that winter mindset with winter surface instabilities and how easy that can surprise us. And I'm looking at the forecast and guess what? We have like some snow coming this weekend. It's almost like similar timing to this time last year, but
we're going to be skiing POW on the 1 year anniversary, I think. So I'm going to go ski Purgatory. It sounds like their closing day is on the 28th if they don't melt out before then. So whatever that looks like, it'll be skiing and that'll be cool. It's a good way, I feel like, to kind of cap off a full year is just make some turns with some friends and like enjoy the sliding on snow in any way.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, awesome, guys. Thank you so much for taking the time. Do you have any final thoughts or notes you want to get out there?
I'm excited to ski with Ryan again. Every day I get to ski with Ryan is a great day out. And we've had a couple good ones this season too. And I'm looking forward to...
Well, that's how I initially heard about the story, because I was like, wow, everyone loves Ryan. Everyone's telling me about Ryan over in Silverton who had this accident. And I just knew him as the guy who ran the Cripple Creek shop. But it's been great to get to know you, Ryan. And thank you so much for sharing this story, man. And it's just like one that's really relatable and really important to remember, like this time of year, especially as we move into late April and May ski season. Like, yeah, we have to kind of remember these stories and just keep our wits about us out there. And yeah, I took a lot from this conversation. So I appreciate you guys taking the time.
Thanks, Chris. And yeah, day one listener of the Snowcast. So not maybe how I wanted to make an appearance, but I'm glad to share the story. I think it's really helpful, and it's been a big part of my process of working through my feelings around this accident, has been sharing it in avenues that are hopefully helpful. So I appreciate anybody listening and who stuck around with us through the whole thing. So
yeah, for sure. And next year we'll have you on the Hot Takes episode. Don't worry.
Sounds good. I might be good for that.
Well, that is a wrap on this season of the San Juan Snowcast. Thanks again for tuning in. It's been a hell of a ride this season with some great interviews and stories, and I'm super grateful for everyone that came on the show this year. You know, the San Juans can feel like a big mountain range sometimes, but the fact is, our backcountry community is small. At our core, we're a group of like-minded adventurers who find challenge and reward in exploring our local mountains by way of skins and snow. No matter what motivates you to get out into the backcountry, we're all bound by the simple fact that we earn each and every turn the natural way, by trudging uphill. We've all got a lot more in common with each other than we think, and the strength of our community, well, it depends directly on the conversations between strangers in the parking lot, the bonds formed on the skin track, and the shared responsibility we have for each other's safety when we're out there. Now, my hope is that this podcast continues to foster that sense of camaraderie and community amongst the backcountry skiers and riders of the San Juans. You know, folks, we've got something real special down here. We all play a part in maintaining the magic that is found within these mountains. So, whether you ride on Red Mountain Pass or in the La Platas or down by Wolf Creek or outside Silverton,
Or even if you drop into Bear Creek, or heck, even if you tour way out there by Creed and Lake City, guess what? You're a part of the San Juan Backcountry community. Whether it's your 20th season in these mountains or your first, you matter. And I'm going to leave you with one more of my favorite sayings from a sage mentor of mine, and it goes like this. A stranger in the mountains is just a friend you haven't made yet. Thanks again to Ryan and Isaiah for sharing their story this week. And thanks again to you for being a part of this project with me. Without you, well, I'd just be talking to myself on here. So I really do appreciate you tuning in. I hope you have an incredible rest of your spring ski season, folks. And, well, until next time, think snow.